Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, in the United States, mass school shootings are most likely to happen in small towns and suburban areas. One example is the shooting last week at a high school in Santa Fe, Texas. 10 people died in the attack. The Associated Press examined records for the 10 deadliest shootings in American schools. All but one of those attacks took place in a town with fewer than 75,000 people. Most were in communities of less than 50,000 people. Small, rural, and suburban towns are seemingly perfect places for children to grow up. They generally have low crime rates and good schools. There also is a sense of community, where everyone seems to know your name. Experts say it is exactly those qualities that make rural and suburban towns a good home for the next school shooter. Peter Langman has been studying school shootings for years. Langman is a psychologist. He keeps records of school gun violence in the U.S. and overseas. He said, "People tend to think of violence associated with cities, not violence associated with small-town America. But this type of violence is the one associated with small-town America." Experts say there could be a number of reasons for the connection between small towns and gun violence. They include few restrictions on guns in such communities and the effect of troubled teenagers copying each other's behavior. The pressure of living in smaller towns is another reason. Experts say those pressures make it harder for troubled teens to overcome problems. James Allen Fox is a professor at Northeastern University in Massachusetts. He has been studying mass shootings for years. He notes, "In small-town America, it's said everybody knows everybody, and that's well and good, except when you don't want everybody to know what's going on with you." Fox added, "If things are going downhill for you, you did something wrong or someone did something wrong to you, and some girl dumps you, everybody knows. So it's much harder to get away from it." He noted that it is different in the big city because no one knows your name, and it can be a good thing. In Parkland, Florida, a former student shot and killed 17 people in February. Parkland had just recently been voted the safest town in the state. Newtown, Connecticut seems like many other New England towns. It seems a world away from the crime and problems of Connecticut's biggest cities. Yet in 2012, a school shooting in Newtown took the lives of 20 children and 6 adults. The mass shooting at Columbine High School took place in a community outside Denver, Colorado. The Virginia Tech massacre happened in a college town of about 40,000 people. The shooting last Friday took place in a Texas community of just 13,000 people. The town of Santa Fe is a 40-minute drive from Houston. The number of mass shootings in smaller cities is higher than that of big U.S. cities. New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles have strong gun laws and their own problems with gun violence. But it is rare to see a mass shooting in one of their schools. In the 1980s and 1990s, city governments sought to make schools safer from drug and gang-related violence. They took steps such as setting up metal detection equipment at entrances to schools. That is exactly what pro-gun activists and the National Rifle Association have been proposing after the latest shootings. Some experts say improved school designs and talk of arming teachers fails to solve the problem. People who have been studying mass shooting for years agree. Peter Langman is head of a website called schoolshooters.info. He said students often have a sense that a classmate might be planning an attack or know that someone is troubled. But they might be less likely in smaller towns to tell anyone about the problem. They know each other well, visit each other's homes, and families can be business partners. Langman said, "The best prevention is to catch them early before they show up with a gun, rather than trying to make it hard for them once they're already at the building with a gun." James Allen Fox also said it is hard to overlook the issue of young people copying others' behavior. Fox said the shooters are all Caucasian male teenagers in small towns or rural areas because they identify with other Caucasian male teenagers in small towns or rural areas. He added that they have totally different issues to deal with than African American children in New York or the streets of Chicago.
A phrasal verb is a verb made of two or more words, a verb and a preposition or adverb or both. A great way to learn the meanings of phrasal verbs is to hear how they may be used in real life. Listen to these two people talk to each other. You will hear seven phrasal verbs dealing with food and eating. Try to find them and guess their meanings.
Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Jamie. Good to see you. How's it going?
It's going okay. I'm on my second week of the 30-day good food diet, and it's been hard. I've cut out sugar, grains, and processed foods. Now I snack on things like fruit or nuts in between meals.
I've been hearing a lot about that diet. But it would be impossible for me to give up chocolate for 30 days. Impossible.
Well, my weakness is noodles. I've been dreaming of the ramen from Noodle House, but this month I can't eat out much.
Noodle House, we used to live on ramen noodles back in our college days, remember?
Yes. Well, anyway, the good news is that my favorite dress fits again. But honestly, I'm looking forward to day 31.
Me too. Let's pig out to celebrate.
That would defeat the purpose. I think those pig out days are over for me. But I remember when we used to wolf down huge pizzas in our dorm.
Oh, come on, Jamie. Live a little.
Did you find all seven food-related phrasal verbs? The first one was cut out.
To cut out a food means to stop eating it completely. Jamie has cut out unhealthy foods for her 30-day diet. Cut out is separable. That means the object may go after the verb, or it may appear in the middle of it. Here's Jamie using the verb cut out with the object appearing after the verb.
I've cut out sugar, grains, and processed foods.
The object is sugar, grains, and processed foods. And here's the same sentence with the object in the middle.
I've cut sugar, grains, and processed foods out.
Note that we usually only separate the words of a phrasal verb when the object is not too long. A similar phrasal verb that Jamie and Lauren did not use is cut down on. This verb has three words instead of just two. To cut down on a food means to decrease the amount of it that you eat. Here's an example.
I've cut down on dairy to help lower my cholesterol.
Notice that the object dairy comes after cut down on. That's because cut down on is inseparable. The object must go after the verb. Okay, our next verb is snack on. To snack on something means to eat a small amount of it between meals. Since last week, Jamie has been snacking on healthy foods.
Now I snack on things like fruit or nuts in between meals.
The verb snack on is inseparable. And unfortunately, Jamie won't be separated from her fruit and nuts anytime soon. Next, we have give up. To give up something means to stop having, doing, or using it. Lauren refuses to give up chocolate, so she is not interested in trying the diet. Give up is separable. Listen to Lauren use the verb with the object chocolate appearing after it.
But it would be impossible for me to give up chocolate for 30 days. Impossible.
And with the object in the middle.
But it would be impossible for me to give chocolate up for 30 days. Impossible.
Well, maybe not impossible. Now let's talk about an easy one, eat out. To eat out means to eat at a restaurant, not at a home. Eat out is an inseparable verb. And Jamie isn't eating out a lot during her diet. She tells Lauren,
"But this month I can't eat out much."
I wonder what she'll make for dinner. The next phrasal verb is live on. To live on a food means to have a specific food as the only or main food that you eat. Jamie and Lauren lived on ramen noodles in college.
We used to live on ramen noodles back in our college days, remember?
The verb live on is inseparable, and Jamie is still dreaming of ramen. Okay, now we have pig out. Think about the way pigs eat. Do they eat a lot? Of course. So to pig out means to eat a lot of food at one time. It is very informal, which is why you heard it used between two friends. Lauren said,
"Let's pig out to celebrate."
Here, Lauren doesn't mention a specific food. But when we use this verb with an object, we must use the preposition on. Listen to an example of Lauren talking about specific foods.
Let's pig out on pizza and noodles to celebrate.
Note that the object, pizza and noodles, comes after the verb, as the verb is inseparable. Our last phrasal verb today is wolf down. To wolf down something means to eat something very quickly. It's another very informal phrasal verb. Back in college, Jamie and Lauren would wolf down large pizzas.
But I remember when we used to wolf down huge pizzas in our dorm.
Huge pizzas is the object. In the example, it appears after wolf down. But since this verb is separable, Jamie could have also said this.
But I remember when we used to wolf huge pizzas down in our dorm.
Well, that's all the time we have today. Join us again soon for more food-related phrasal verbs. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1914, Europe exploded into the First World War. It was a war no nation really wanted, but no nation seemed able to stop it. The assassination of Austria's Archduke Franz Ferdinand in the city of Sarajevo was the spark that set off the explosion. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about the war and how it affected the United States under President Woodrow Wilson.
The Austrian Archduke was murdered by Serbian nationalists. They opposed Austrian control of their homeland. After the assassination, Austria declared war on Serbia. One of Serbia's allies was Russia. Russia agreed to help Serbia in any war against Austria. Austria had allies, too. The most important was Germany. Germany wanted Russia to stay out of the war. When Russia refused, Germany declared war on Russia. Then Germany declared war on Russia's close ally, France. Britain entered the war a few days later, when Germany violated the neutrality of Belgium.
One nation after another entered the conflict to protect its friends or to honor its treaties. Within a week, most of Europe was at war. On one side were the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary. On the other side were the Triple Entente allies, France, Britain, and Russia. Many other nations took sides. Bulgaria and Turkey joined the Central Powers. Italy, Romania, Portugal, and Greece joined the Allies.
The United States hoped to stay out of the war. President Wilson immediately declared American neutrality. He said, "It is a war with which we have nothing to do, whose causes cannot touch us." Most Americans agreed with President Wilson. They did not want to get involved in the fighting. However, many found it difficult to remain neutral in their hearts. Some Americans had family roots in Germany. They supported the Central Powers. A greater number of Americans had family roots in Britain or France. They supported the Allies. Yet the official American policy was neutrality. The United States planned to continue to trade with both sides.
Germany and Austria expected a quick victory in the war. They were caught between two powerful enemies, Russia and France. But German military leaders were not worried. They had a battle plan they were sure would succeed. The German generals planned to strike quickly at France with most of the German army. They expected to defeat France in a short time and then turn to fight Russia. In this way, the German army would not have to fight both enemies at the same time.
At first, the plan worked. 2 million German soldiers swept across Belgium and into France. They rushed forward toward Paris, hoping for a fast victory. But the German commanders made a mistake. They pushed their men too fast. When British and French forces struck back outside Paris, the tired and worn German soldiers could not hold their positions. The battle was fierce and unbelievably bloody. In the end, the Germans were forced to withdraw. The German withdrawal gave the Allies time to prepare strong defenses. There was no chance now for a quick German victory. Instead, it would be a long war, with Germany and Austria facing enemies on two sides. Britain and France were on the west, Russia was on the east.
The Allies took immediate steps to reduce Germany's trade with the rest of the world. The British Navy began seizing war supplies found on neutral ships sailing toward German ports. It then expanded its efforts to block food exports to Germany. The blockade by Britain and the other Allies was very successful. Germany faced possible starvation. Its navy was not strong enough to break the blockade with surface ships. Its only hope was to break the blockade with another naval weapon, submarines. Germany announced that it would use its submarines to sink any ship that came near the coast of Britain. The threat included ships from neutral nations that tried to continue trading with the Allies.
The United States and other neutral nations immediately protested the German announcement. They said it was a clear violation of international law. When a German submarine sank a British ship in the Irish Sea, one of the victims was an American citizen. A few weeks later, an American oil ship was damaged during a sea battle between British Navy ships and a German submarine. Then came the most serious incident of all. It involved a British passenger ship called the Lusitania. The Lusitania was sailing from New York City to Britain when it was attacked by a German submarine. The Lusitania sank in 18 minutes. 1,200 persons were killed. 129 were Americans.
The sinking of the Lusitania shocked and horrified the American people. They called it mass murder. They turned against Germany. President Wilson warned that he might declare war on Germany if Germany continued to sink civilian ships. Germany did not want war with the United States. It already faced a strong fight against the European allies. It promised not to sink any more civilian ships without warning, and it offered regrets for the Lusitania incident.
President Wilson accepted Germany's apology. Like most Americans, he hoped to stay out of the bloody European struggle. And he also knew that the record of the Allies was not completely clean. For example, he was troubled by reports of mass hunger in Germany. He and other Americans felt the British food blockade was cruel. They also were shocked by the way British forces brutally crushed a rebellion in Ireland at the time. Most of all, the American people were sickened by reports of what was happening on the battlefields of Europe. The armies were using poison gas and other terrible weapons. Soldiers on both sides were dying by the millions. The war had become a bloodbath.
The United States had a presidential election in 1916. President Wilson won the nomination of the Democratic Party to seek re-election. Democrats around the country shouted their support with these words: "He kept us out of war." Wilson himself did not like the words. He felt it raised false hopes. But people continued to say it because they did not want war.
The Republican Party nominated Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes as its candidate for president. Hughes was a moderate Republican. He supported a number of social reforms. Like Wilson, Hughes promised to keep the United States neutral. However, one of his supporters was former President Theodore Roosevelt. And Roosevelt called for strong American policies that could lead to war. Roosevelt's words led many Americans to see Wilson as the candidate of peace, and Hughes as the candidate of war.
Voting in the presidential election was very close. At first, it seemed Hughes had won. He went to bed on election night, believing he would be America's next president. But voting results later that night confirmed Wilson as the winner. The election was so close, the Republicans did not accept defeat for 2 weeks. Woodrow Wilson had won another term. During that term, he would find it increasingly difficult to honor the words of the campaign: "He kept us out of war." Finally, he would find it impossible. The United States entered World War I while Woodrow Wilson was president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.